Okay, well let's get started. A couple weeks ago, Jesse talked about stage three. For those of you that aren't familiar with Chuladasa's technique, he teaches a staged approach to meditation. And in each stage, there's certain things that you work on. There's challenges and things that you work on in each particular stage, and you move along through the stages. And so Jesse covered the beginning of stage three. And I'm going to finish it up. And some of the topics that we touched on tonight, dullness and drowsiness is one of them, and then also pain and discomfort in meditation. So I'm going to cover that. Then I'm going to get into some things about in stage four about working with the mind and as well as your meditation object, knowing what your mind's doing, knowing when you're dull or drowsy, knowing when you're overly agitated, that sort of thing. So what happens, when we start sitting longer, we start to develop a regular practice. Our attention gets a little more stable. Maybe we start doing longer sets. Come here, maybe you do a 45-minute set. Then what tends to happen is we start to get some discomfort in meditation. Anytime you sit still for a long period of time, there can arise discomfort. No matter how comfortable you get, you might have some discomfort somewhere. So basically, we're gonna talk about some techniques for working with that discomfort. The first thing you do, say you're focusing on a meditation object. I'm gonna use the breath and meditation object synonymously, but you don't have to focus on the breath. That's just one particular meditation object. But I will use both of those because the main technique that Chuladasa teaches is breath meditation. But please feel free to substitute your favorite object in there. You could do a mantra, you could do just body sensations. Some people do sounds as a meditation object. So there's a lot of different options there. So the first thing you'll do is if a painful sensation comes up, first thing to try is just ignoring it. Just you'll notice it, it'll come into awareness, you'll have this peripheral awareness. Say you have a pain in your knee, it comes into your awareness, and you just let go of it, and you just bring your attention back to the sensations of the breath. Let that be in the background. It didn't have to go away. You try not to resist it. Just let it be in the background. And also resist the urge to move at first, because what can happen is, you're sitting there, and, oh, okay, I've got a pain. Yeah, I better move. This is going to hurt. If I sit here much longer, this is really going to start hurting. And so you move, And then 30 seconds later, it feels better. You moved, it feels better. Then another pain might come up somewhere else, either in that spot or another spot. And you can get into this endless cycle of pain, move, aversion. You're just going around in circles. So at first, resist that urge. Unless it's an excruciating pain and it's just something you can't deal with, resist that urge at first, and just come back. Keep coming back to the meditation object. Now, if it gets persistent, if it keeps coming back, you're with the breath for one breath, and then boom, your attention goes right to that sensation again. Then at that point, it's getting too persistent just to ignore. So the first thing you want to try is to make that your meditation object. So instead of focusing on the breath, the sensations of the breath, for example, you're going to actually switch to that painful sensation. We're just looking at sensations. So a painful sensation is just as good as a breath sensation in terms of developing these qualities of mind, developing attention, developing awareness. So move your attention there and just examine it. What do you feel? Say you have a pain in your knee. What do you feel? Find the boundaries of it. How big is it? Is it changing? Is it stronger one minute? Does it pulse? Does it go away sometimes? Does it, maybe you don't feel anything for a couple of seconds, and then maybe it comes back stronger. And then, so you try to observe it with as little resistance as possible. Try to let go of the resistance and just observe it like you're a neutral observer of the whole process. And then what can happen is either it'll get worse, it'll stay the same, or it'll diminish. And so just kind of stick with it. But try not to have the expectation that it's going to go away. Sometimes when you just observe it, it just kind of fades away, or it can turn into just sensations. You lose that resistance, and you still feel the sensations of the pain, but you don't feel it as pain. You've let go of the resistance, so it's just sensations. They're just raw body sensation. So when that happens, when it goes away, or if it diminishes, then turn around and go back to your regular meditation object, whatever that may be. If it's really persistent and it's really getting strong, everybody has their limitation of how mindful they can be and how much resistance that they have. And if it gets really strong, and then move. change your position. But when you do that, do it very mindfully. You know, decide you're going to move at the end of the next exhale, for example, and then, you know, move very slowly and mindfully. You know, feel the sensations while you're moving, and get yourself more comfortable, because you want to differentiate between pain that can cause damage and just the normal pain of sitting still for long periods of time. You know, a good test is if you get up after your meditation and you know, you're still hurting 30 minutes later, you probably need to adjust your posture, change something up. That's a physical type pain. But you know, you get up, you walk around a little bit, and you're fine. That was probably just a meditation pain. So, you know, use some wisdom there as to what the source of the pain might be. So any questions? I want to try to make this, you know, interactive as opposed to just lecture. So, you know, any questions, thoughts, anybody experience anybody else has had dealing with pain that might be helpful for someone? Brian?
I learned the hard way that differentiating between being uncomfortable in meditation and actual pain is a huge deal. I mean, we mentioned making that differentiation, but, you know, if you're somebody who would just go through it, it's really important to make that clear distinction between which is which.
Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out.
Because I sat there in knee pain for way too long. You know, now I'm working with it in lots of other ways, but, you know, I probably didn't tear a meniscus doing it, but I probably didn't make it any better sitting through it.
Right.
I mean, I don't think the meditation caused the injury per se, but it didn't help the situation.
Yeah. Were you sitting cross-legged? Were you sitting cross-legged?
Yeah. Just like you.
Right. Yeah. That one's particularly one to really take notice of, you know, because most of us as Westerners aren't accustomed to sitting in a cross-legged position. And so if your knees start to bother you, that definitely is a flag, and you know, notice that and work with it skillfully. Right.
The question, those of you that have been around meditation a long time, I mean, has anybody actually really hurt themselves? You know, like, so, I mean, I would think at some point our survival instinct would just kick in and like, we're not gonna hurt ourselves. We're gonna do what we gotta do to actually.
Yeah, I've known people who have,
you know, it's just
hurt them. I mean, like, you know, like I didn't help mine, but I don't think that this is how I injured it. But I know people who have forced themselves to sit in this posture, even lotus long, I mean, when they had no business doing it, and now they just can't do this well. Either, you know, I mean, it's some people will convince themselves to just sit through it to the point, and it doesn't take much to damage a knee. It's a pretty fragile joint.
Yeah, I have heard of it happening too. You know, in nerve damage, sitting in one posture too long. You know, when I do a retreat, I often alternate different postures. Like a meditation retreat where you're sitting sit after sit all day long, I will change different things. You know, sometimes I'll sit cross-legged, sometimes I'll sit on a bench, you know, up in seiza position like this. Or you can do it on a, you know, you can do it on a cushion as well. You know, vary it up that way, sometimes sitting in a chair. So I think that can be helpful to vary up your postures and develop different postures, especially if you're, you know, you'll be sitting all day long for long periods of time. Certainly can help, because it, you know, puts different stress on different parts of your body when you're sitting in a different position. You know, when you're sitting on this or on like a bench, well, the pressure point is your bottom. You know, after a longer period of time, that's what gets sore. But I don't usually feel anything in my knees when I'm sitting in this type of posture. So that can be helpful. I know I did a retreat recently with Shenzhen Yang, who's a, you know, long-term meditator and teacher, and he was having some knee pain when he got up from the sits. And somebody asked him about it, and he said, well, you know, I spent too much time in my youth in these Zen monasteries in Japan sitting in full lotus position. He said he used to sit 2 hours in full lotus, no big deal. Well, it came back to haunt him at some point. So that's a really good point, is to really try to take care of your body while you're sitting. You know.
I know a fair amount of research has come out recently with regard to how bad it is for humans to sit for long periods of time here at all. Right. It's just not good for us. I don't know if that's at all applicable here, because I don't know how many people here really just sit for 16 hours a day meditating. I'm just bringing up as an idea that doing too much of that at one time is supposed to be really bad for the whole cardiovascular system. So how do we accommodate that, especially in something like a retreat?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah, you're right. There are finding more and more research that's saying that. And, you know, your daily practice is probably not going to make a huge difference if you're active the rest of your day. But when you start talking about retreats where you may be sitting, 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day, it could become an issue. Now, typically on a retreat, you'll alternate. You'll alternate sitting meditation with walking meditation. And I think walking is very good from that perspective, both for your overall health and just to change it up and, on your postures and things like that. You know, often retreats will have some kind of movement, mindful movement, like yoga, for example, or Tai Chi or something like that. So I think you definitely would want to try to strike some kind of balance there. Because I think people give precedence to seated meditation on retreat, but you can actually get lots of benefit from walking meditation and mindful movement and that sort of thing as well. So that's something to keep in mind. Some people think, well, walking meditation is just kind of a break between sitting, but it really can be a very powerful form of meditation in and of itself.
And another thing, just another thought about that, if you're going to sit behind your computer for 3 hours, you're in sort of your normal waking mode with all the emotions and all that stuff that, you know, the normal day things that come up. But when you're meditating, you're in a different part of the nervous system that's, I mean, you're in a whole different frame of mind, and there's a whole different physiological environment that's happening too, that's going to affect the body differently than just sitting in a car for 8 hours or, you know, sitting behind a computer all day long.
Yeah, you're right. It could be, different. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know how much that changes the environment as far as, you know, this kind of scientific study goes, but it's a little bit different kind of thing. Psychologically.
That's right. There is a spot you get to later in this practice, you know, stage 8 and 9 called physical pliancy, where you actually get where you can actually sit for long periods of time without any kind of pain. You know, you can actually get up and you have no knee pain, no, your feet aren't asleep, that sort of thing. And so something different physiologically is probably happening when you get to that level of physical pliancy. I think someone asked Shula Das about it. He wasn't exactly sure what was going on physiologically, but the fact that you could do that, you could do like a 4-hour sit and you get up and you walk and you're not stiff and you feel, your body feels great, means something different is going on. I don't know if it's the same mechanism that causes some of the cardiovascular effects from being seated or not.
I would think that the biggest problem for the cardiovascular system is stress, and by meditating long periods, you're actually reducing the stress. And like Brian said, it's sort of something else is going on. And I don't have statistics, but it does seem like some of these Zen guys and stuff will live to a ripe old age. And I think that whatever ease they're developing in meditation probably counteracts or overcomes the effect of the stillness. That's just my own opinion.
My experience with sitting for a long time, most of my career, I'm sitting at a computer, and injuries would develop. I had carpal tunnel syndrome, tennis elbow. I mean, and part of that for me was because I was sitting still, but I wasn't breathing like we think of it here, but I was just in my mind. And when you're just in your mind, you really leave your body, and bad things can be happening, but you're not aware of it at all. And then, you know, the pain comes about, could be days or weeks later with repetitive things. So I've recently retired, and I'm trying to improve my posture. And because I'm working on it, a lot of my new muscles are sensitive, a little sore. But I think if I was sitting upright comfortably, I really feel a big difference between what I used to be doing. And I just think here with the breath, the breath and the spine working together in proper alignment, I just feel such a difference in my body. It's much more comfortable, much more open. And well, of course, when I'm doing yoga or trying to meditate, I'm much more aware of my body.
Right.
But it doesn't, I mean, I'm having pain because I have all these new muscles right now, but that I've been working. But I think the sitting up straight is like you said, without the stress or whatever pulls your consciousness just into some focused attention. Like it's over here, it's not really in here or in here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's when I had injuries.
Right.
Or developed problems then. So I'm thinking of sitting meditation as well as other stuff I'm doing as a way to keep reinforcing that sensation of sitting comfortably.
Right. And that's a very good point you brought up, because we talk about the difference between attention and awareness. What happens in a case like that where we're focused on the computer or whatever, we have a lot of attention on what we're doing, but we're losing that awareness of our body. You know, we might sit there 2 hours trying to solve a problem, but yet our body's suffering the whole time. And we don't even realize it because we have lost that peripheral awareness. You know, some people say that we have an attention problem, but I think we also have an awareness problem as well. Sometimes we're overly focused, hyper-focused, and we don't have that more global type awareness. So I think that can help and provide a different sort of effect. Anything else on sitting or pain or?
Well, I had been, I built myself a stool.
Oh, did you?
But I find I've got a posture problem, and the stool kept me upright.
Uh-huh.
And at home I've got kneeling stools. I use, you know, the kneeling chairs where you just kneel, put your knees down.
Oh, yeah. Thinking.
And they're very, very, I think they're a lot better than a chair.
Yeah, they keep that curve in your lower back. You know, they tend to tilt your pelvis forward, and they keep that nice curve in your lower back. And it's possible it just was the bench with your knees, but I wonder if the height was just right. If there was too much pressure on your knee and not enough on your bottom, it could have been part of the knee problem. I don't know.
Sizes of legs.
Yeah.
And I never did finish it. You know, I decided it was going to be portable. So I had the mortise and tenon on it, and uh-huh. I had different sets of legs.
Okay, so you experimented with different types.
Yeah. But then I found different issues. I took this kneeling chair to the retreat I did in New Mexico, and I found other issues with it for setting multiple times.
Yeah, that's always the tricky part. You know, things work for one set, but if you do them five or six sets, then they get different.
Sort of alternating, you know, the stacking the pillows up and kneeling down on chairs.
Right.
Just keep alternating.
Yeah.
The one thing that I sometimes try to keep my eye on when the pain is arising is kind of, you know, how much equanimity I've got, and it'll kind of tend to wear out over time. And so it's like, if I push through the pain long enough to where I no longer have any equanimity with it, then I kind of feel like that's probably not that productive. Like if I can't really handle it, but I just force myself to stay there, but I'm actually like really gritting my teeth, then I guess I don't feel like that's that useful. It's like I only allow myself to experience as much pain as I can have some amount of equanimity with it.
Yeah.
If it's beyond that, point. Then I move.
Yeah, that's a good idea, because we all have our limits, you know, and they may increase over time. We may develop more equanimity over time, but we definitely have that. And at some point, it probably isn't productive just to sit through. You know? So that's where we have to experiment and try things.
One thing that I found in long retreat was to meditate lying down. You know, I mean, like, you know, flat on your back on a relatively firm surface, you know, like a carpeted floor or something. It took a little getting used to, right? Because usually when you lie down, you fall asleep. Mm-hmm. So it's a it's a different experience that took some getting used to. But for most people, they can lie there for quite a long time without developing bodily pain. But at least it's a totally different kind of variety of position for your body. It is a little bit weird. You know, I mean, sitting in a chair took me some getting used to, too. It felt too casual.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not really meditating. I'm sitting in a chair. Right? But I got to the, once I kind of got past it, it's, for me, it's, you know, once I got the height worked out and all that, it was so comfortable that I could sit there for like an hour and multiple sits, and it didn't bother me at all. But I did experiment with a lying down position because it was so different. It was such a different position for all the joints than any version of sitting that it was an interesting experiment. One, in just a totally different meditation experience.
Yeah.
And two, you know, just to give the body something different to do. You know, when you're talking about the context of, you know, 6, 8, you know, 10 hours a day of sitting, like if you're in a serious retreat.
Yeah, you also get to work with dullness too.
Yeah.
That's an added benefit.
My claim of restfulness, I went to China for 3 weeks 8 years ago, and it was before I started meditating. And I wasn't always in a nice hotel, and those people, you know, they squat.
In the bathroom.
Right. In the East. And I noticed that there was tremendous strength needed to lift yourself up. And I just always kind of had this frame of reference that the people in the East, their muscles from just sitting differently with that function, you know. And when I started meditating then, I just felt like I haven't been, you know, used to doing this, and I already have this deal with my mind to deal with, and I think it will just be too much to do the body and the mind. And so I never really had any desire to learn to sit like that. I just feel like, I know posture is important, and I, you know, concentrate on my sitting bones, but I have a bad knee, and I know I would have pain. So I don't know. I'm just going to be a chair sitter.
Well, when I was having knee pain, I was telling Chilla Dawes about it, and he's like, well, why are you sitting on the floor? Like, if it's causing, I mean, it took me a while to get it through my skull that I just needed to quit fighting through it. But he was kind of like, well, then don't sit on the floor then. Like, right? I mean, it seemed really, it was a simple answer from him. And then, you know, and I'm like, but, you know, but it was like, there's nothing magical about sitting. And you asked about, you know, sitting forward. There's a lot, I mean, Chula also leans back, you know. I know that Jesse finds that to be more comfortable. I mean, as long as you're reasonably upright and you don't fall into the... But those are the first people that I've known that actually sat back in the chair. I mean, ergonomics are important, you know, but still. So it's for me, with all my yoga background, it sort of calls into question all the things that I've just accepted as truisms about meditation posture and this and that and the other thing. It's like, well, if it's working and it's, you know, doesn't have some hindrance somewhere along the road, then sit in a chair. Great.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's comfortable, then, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
I never understood it to be superior to sit on the floor. And I've never taken up even trying it, or I tried it once, but I thought, no, I stick with the chair, and I never felt like I'm doing something less because I'm in a chair.
Right. Yeah. Probably because meditation developed in the East, and they didn't have chairs as much. They sat on the floor more. That's probably how it developed originally. And their muscles have developed differently, like you were talking about, because yes, they do sit like that.
It can be extremely useful.
Right.
It is a little bit different energetic experience, just like the way your body feels and just the way everything orients itself sitting in different positions. Like sitting on the floor just feels different than sitting in a chair. Right.
It does, but you know, to get a good posture, I can get that in the chair.
Right.
Actually better than I can get it on the floor because I can't get my knees down and then
right. But in the end does it matter?
No, that's what I mean.
It's like okay.
It's like wearing robes. I mean, it's pretty much a cultural artifact.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean there may be someone who can really detect the energy differences, but there's not many of us who are at that.
Well, John Kabat-Zinn highly suggests laying down at least once a day. Yeah. I think I read somewhere.
Alan Wallace is a huge advocate of
lying
down meditation.
Yeah, I say experiment. Try it. See what works for you. Lots of things work.
In my posture fitness class today, we closed a session with something called static back, which is where you lay on your back with your calves up on a chair or some support so that everything's perpendicular, straight lines. And she said that what it does is it takes all of the stress off your back. You move around until you can feel that everything's lying relaxed and your neck is in the right place. And static just means no gravity, nothing pulling anything in any direction. And I actually think now that I'm saying, I know that we're having this discussion, that might be one way for me to meditate.
You could certainly try.
Until my back is more accustomed to the stacked spine.
Well,
that's a cool idea. That position requires, the body requires no muscular effort to stay in that particular position where you're everything 90 degrees.
Yeah. It was great today after we did some strenuous exercise and then relax that way. It felt really good.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, anything else on pain or posture? Okay, let's talk a little bit about dullness and drowsiness. I know that's an issue for some of us. And what tends to happen as our attention starts to stabilize, we start to get drowsy. I mean, we equate that with sleep. You know, that's what we do in the night. We lay down, we relax, we slowly let go of things in our mind, and we get sleepy and we go to sleep. And so that's our conditioning. And so that can often happen in meditation as well. You know, as we start to develop a little skill, our mind's just not all over the place. As we get a little more concentration on the breath, then we start to get drowsy. And there's a whole range of what we call drowsiness or dullness. We can call either one. First part could be you're just a little bit spaced out. You know, you're with the meditation object, but everything's a little spacey, and you know, your attention's kind of diffuse, and there's not a lot of clarity there on the meditation object. And what this is really it's really like a scattering of attention. At that point, because you might have a couple of moments of awareness on the meditation object, and then you have a couple of moments where you're not really experiencing anything. You know, you're just non-perceiving moments, as opposed to when your mind's going out to distractions. You're either between your meditation object or you're on a distraction. Your attention is, but in this case, you're just kind of on nothing there, and you kind of feel like you're in a fog. I think we've all kind of had that experience. And then what can happen is you start out with some subtle dullness, and then it can actually go into strong dullness. And that's when you really start getting sleepy. That's kind of when you have the Zen lurch, where you feel like you lose your posture. You might start having some imagery come up, that hypnagogic imagery, like dreamlike imagery that can come up. The first thing you need to look at is, are there any physical causes of this drowsiness? You know, are you getting enough sleep? You know, often people don't get enough sleep. So that's one of the first things to look at. Are you getting enough sleep? Do you have any health conditions? For example, sleep apnea or anything along those lines that may be impacting you. And then also, you know, look at the time of day. You know, if we eat a big lunch and we try to meditate after lunch, most of us are going to be sleepy. And so that's kind of key when you set up your meditation time, that you maybe pick a time when you're a little bit more alert. Sometimes first thing in the morning, you know, sometimes, you know, late in the afternoon can be a good time for people. Sometimes later in the evening can be. It all depends. Different people have different rhythms and things that work for them. And but what can happen, you know, once you've ruled out any physical causes, then you actually have, you know, the causes that are caused by meditation. And so what do we do if we get into this really strong dullness? One of the first things is if you can catch it early, that helps. You start to realize, you know, if you can catch it when it's just subtle dullness and you can sharpen up your attention, or like Brian mentioned, you can increase your awareness of the rest of the of your environment, that can help wake up the mind. These are kind of progressive remedies that you can apply if you get drowsy and sleepy. One of the first things you can do is you can open your eyes. You know, just letting some light in sometimes can help wake you up a little bit, especially if you're in a well-lit room like this. That can be helpful. Adjust your posture. You know, if you're kind of slumping, that's more sleepy. You know, straighten your spine a little bit. That can also wake you up. So the combination of opening your eyes and adjusting your posture, then it might be enough to wake you up. If that doesn't work, then you might try tensing and releasing your muscles. You know, some of those exercises, relaxation exercises where you tense all the muscles. You might try that 4 or 5 times and see if that kind of energizes you. If that doesn't work, the next thing to try would be standing meditation. Even if you're in a group environment, you can easily quietly stand up and try meditating while you're standing up. And sometimes you're still drowsy even when you're standing up, but you catch yourself a lot earlier. You know, before you fall asleep, you're going to start leaning or trying to get off balance, and so you can catch it much earlier. You know, if that's not enough, then try walking meditation. That can be energizing. And you know, if all else fails, you know, do some walking meditation to the bathroom, splash some cold water in your face. So those are all different techniques you can use. Some they're from the more subtle to the more drastic as you go down the list. And but you know, if you do one of these remedies and you start sinking immediately, you know, you start getting sleepy just right away, you probably didn't do enough. Either you didn't do it long enough, or you need a stronger remedy, you know, for that. So those are some ideas of working with dullness and drowsiness. So any comments on that, or anything anybody else tries that works well for them, or anything like that?
I'm just thinking of that. If really nothing else helps.
And that could be.
Why force yourself for an hour of drowsiness?
Right. That could certainly be one of the remedies. And especially if you really are sleep deprived, mm-hmm. maybe you are better off going and taking a nap for a while and then coming back and meditating after you've done that. But you know, if it's a persistent pattern, I think like Brian was mentioning, if you just get sleepy every time you meditate and there's no physical cause to it, maybe there's some aversion going on. Maybe part of your mind doesn't really want to meditate, so it just kind of goes to sleep. So in that case, a nap might not be in your best interest, but, you know, you could certainly look at that and see, you know, if you do take a nap and you come back and you're able to meditate, well, then you probably were just sleepy. So. Anything else? Anything?
Sometimes I count just to 5, but that helps me, just counting to just to 5. I guess, is that working my concentration? Or?
Are you counting the breaths, or are you just counting in general?
I'm just counting.
Yeah, that could be helping your concentration, because you're having to focus on the numbers. You can also do that with the breath. You know, at the end of each exhale, for example, you can count. You know, at the end of the first exhale, count 1, next one, count 2,
uh-huh.
and kind of combine those two methods. And that can kind of tell you, if you you're losing count, that can kind of tell you you're dull. Sometimes you can count up to 10 and you can start over. Chuladasa usually recommends counting to 10 at the beginning of your meditation set. And once you've successfully gotten to 10, then you can let go of it. But if you get dull or if you get agitated, then you might count again at a different point of your meditation. So that can be helpful. The counting can be helpful to let you know what your mental state is when you first start meditating. You can see how agitated your mind is. Because if you lose count, or, you know, lose the meditation object to mind wandering, then you start over at one. So you can tell by how many times you end up having to start over before you get to 10 and give you an overall state of what your mind's like when you start.
My favorite one is when I end up on like 15 and I, you know, when the counting's become automatic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
15. where did that go?
Yeah, it can get automatic. And that's why I usually recommend is just counting to 10 and not keep counting throughout your whole session, because it can become automatic at some point. And so, and it's less beneficial at that point. But any other things that people try?
You can go to the extreme of like, I mean, you can only do this when you're not in a group, but like little jumping jacks, or I mean, just really sort of get, you know, jumping up and down. And sometimes it's too much, like it spikes you up and then you can bring it down again. But I've played with all, you know, Chilid also told me once, it's like, if you have to, you know, drop and do 10 push-ups to get the, you know, to get the dullness to go away for a short period of time, like do whatever you have to do. So I get really creative.
Yeah, that's and different things will work for different people. So, you know, experiment. Don't be afraid to try different things and see what works. So another thing that can help is, you know, once you've actually awakened yourself, is to try to maintain what we call more external or extrospective awareness. In other words, I think, and this is what Brian mentioned, you know, make sure that you know what's going on in your environment. You're not so overly focused on the breath that you lose track of things. You know, are you noticing sound still? Are you still feeling body sensation? That can help energize the mind. And, you know, if you try that you know, it's still pretty severe, another thing you can do is just let go of the breath altogether and just focus on the whole world, anything in the present moment, kind of like we did at the beginning of the sit today. And just let your attention go from one thing to another, but try to keep it out of the past and the future, but just keep it in the present. And it can be body sensations, smells, if there's smells in your environment, anything in the present moment, thoughts. Thoughts are a good thing to notice as well.
So is dullness like not being...
You're sort of present. You're present part of the time. In other words, so say you're on the breath, and maybe you notice a few sensations at the beginning of the inhale, and then you kind of go away for a while, and maybe you catch something at the end of the inhale, and then maybe you notice one sensation in the middle of the exhale. So you're still present, but you have a lot of gaps in your presence. That's subtle dullness. Then it can go even further, where you're not so dull you don't even notice any of the breath, or you might have noticed one breath and you don't notice anything else for like five breaths, and then you start noticing some more breath sensations. Does that make sense?
It helps me think about what it feels like when you're dull. It's like you're no longer present, so then you drift away and then you come back to your breath or your object.
Right. And the difference between dullness and distraction is, with dullness, you're really not aware of anything during those gaps. With distraction, you're aware of something else. You're aware of mostly thoughts is what we typically get caught up in, or our mental thoughts, talk, and images, that sort of thing.
One thing I find happens is I get so dull that then my mind gets bored and then I'm off in distraction. So rather than distraction being a result of a mind that's too agitated and is just jumping all over the place, I'll get dull, then the mind's like, well, this is boring. Let's go do something else. So it's sort of tricky to decide which one am I working with. Am I working with the dullness, or am I working with the distraction? And, you know, so it's an interesting, it's like, you know, I mean, falling asleep and then being off dreaming, you know. So.
Yeah, there's definitely a balancing act between that, because like if you focus on the breath too closely, it can go either direction. You know, it can either go into distraction because you're on the breath and then suddenly you're gone and you didn't catch it, you didn't notice that your mind was wandering, or you can get overly focused and you can get dull. So you can really go both directions. And so you want to find a balance there, because, but also if you get too focused on the breath, it can get your mind agitated. You know, if you're trying too hard to focus, stay on there, there's an agitation and you lack relaxation. So it really is a tuning type effect. You know, there's not one right effort. It's going to depend on the situation. You know, you have to kind of adjust based on your mental state, you know, if you're dull or if you're really agitated, some of those sorts of things. Okay, anything else on dullness or drowsiness?
What if your focus on the breath at some point simply makes those things irrelevant rather than, I don't want any other word to use other than that the focus on the breath becomes so sharp that it's not that the things disappear, it's they become irrelevant to the moment.
Yeah, and that can certainly happen because when your focus is strong, you know, you are on the breath, you may notice those things, but they're very much in the periphery. You know, they're not standing out from your peripheral awareness. Think about peripheral vision. You know, if you look at your finger, for example, you focus your attention on the end of your finger, you still have some awareness of things that are outside of that. You still have some visual awareness of those things, but it's not sharp, right? If you look, if you're looking closely at one thing, you have some awareness, but everything is kind of blurry, right? There's no detail. And I think that's what you would have in that particular situation. Is there might be a vague awareness, or if you thought stop and think about it, you realize that you did have some awareness, but most of your attention would be on the breath. Is that the situation you're talking about, or? Yeah.
It sounds a little bit like you might be starting to experience what I've heard referred to as seclusion, where your mind starts to become sort of secluded with the object and the other things become, like you said, less, just not relevant. And
there's no pinging. They're like, it's, to me, it doesn't feel like a dullness. It feels like a sharpness.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have a background in, you're a programmer, right? Or you were? So, I mean, it may actually be pretty natural for you to develop a strong focus. And what you're describing sounds like a positive sharpening of awareness. And unless you find yourself slipping into dullness or getting distracted, then it seems like it's going in the right direction, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I agree with that, because later stages you can get exclusively focused on the breath. But if you try to do it too early, it's not always beneficial. What happened to me is my mind would focus pretty easily on one thing, but the problem was I was losing all that peripheral awareness, and I would be on the breath really, really nicely for about 2 minutes, and then suddenly I look up 5 minutes later, my mind had been wandering that whole time. Because I didn't have that awareness. I wasn't seeing the movement of my mind between one thing and another. And so I found out that I needed to have more of that peripheral awareness to make sure, to catch a distraction before my mind, my attention totally moved to it. So you might experiment with that and see which of the two it is.
I will definitely. Because what I'm trying to describe really is more, I wouldn't even necessarily say that it's on the breath, though it seems related to that. It's more the emptiness of it. It's the,
yeah. Kind of a stillness.
Gone. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah,
Thank you for bringing some clarity to that. Thank you.
And sometimes when we first have experiences, we have to really examine them to see exactly what they are. It may take some experimentation to really get an idea what it would be. Because, you know, we can describe things like this, but your experience may feel different. Like you said, you have trouble finding words for it.
Words.
Yeah, that's always the tricky part. You know, try to describe what chocolate tastes like to someone that has never tasted chocolate. You know, it's hard to do sometimes, or somebody else might describe chocolate totally differently than you would, even though you've both tasted it. So it's a similar thing, I think, with meditation.
One thing, it just occurs to me when you said chocolate, is that one thing just popped into my head is that different states of mind have almost like different tastes, or and a meditation that's sharp or that's concentrated will be, you'll want more of it. It'll be satisfying. You'll be drawn towards it. And a meditation that's dull, there might be a pleasantness, but it's not a satisfying pleasantness. It's like, eventually you're like, oh, I'm just kind of sick of this. You know, even though at first it might be like slipping into a warm bath, and you kind of relax. But it, so there's just that kind of, you know, you'll have, when you hit the state that your mind really likes, that's an indication that, you know, you'll be kind of drawn, and it'll sort of whet your appetite for more of it, I think.
Yeah, that can certainly happen. You know, when you start getting some pleasant sensations in meditation, it makes you want to practice. It makes you want to keep doing it. That can definitely be beneficial. Now, there is one trap, and it's later on in stage five. You can be sitting in subtle dullness, and it can be very pleasant. You're kind of dull, but it's nice. You know, like when you mentioned a warm bath, that kind of brought that to mind. And that can be a little tricky, because that can kind of stall your progress, because it is very pleasant. It is very enjoyable and peaceful. But in stage five, there are specific exercises to work on that subtle dullness, to notice and to recognize it and to work with it. So I think that's where the observation and maybe thinking about your meditation afterwards is always beneficial. You know, if someone says, oh yeah, it was a great meditation, you know, it just went like that. And it could be because you were kind of dull that whole time. So that's something to examine in your own mind, see if that's happening. Okay, any final thoughts? We've got a couple minutes. All right, well, thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Blake.
Thank you.